This free program is paid for by the listeners of WBAI New York. If you're not already a member, think about joining us to help keep free speech alive.
FM here in New York City, that was a rebroadcast of the evening news, Conversación en Español Informativo, which means that without further ado, it is time for this.
Moorish, Orthodox, Radio, Crusade, Anarchism for the Global City, Radical Environmentalism for the Concrete Jungle, Esoteric Explorations of the Secret History of Rebel Culture, the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade. Every Tuesday at midnight after the news, only on listener-supported, non-commercial WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City. Be there.
By the devil where the genocide caper. Little boy Beep has lost his sheep, but I found them in a deep, long sleep. 9,000 miles away from home, living the life of a modern-day Flintstone. We the people supposed to be equal, but the men who wrote that, they was evil. Slave owners who did not include us.
Experiencing technical difficulties. Let's see. Well, just stop it right there, because I can't quite figure out how to deal with the skipping business. But okay. Well, anyway, here we are in the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade. My name is Bill Weinberg. And joining us once again, back by popular demand, is Michael Muhammad Knight, author of most recently The Five Percenters, Islam, Hip-Hop, and The Gods of New York, a rather enigmatic title for the uninitiated. And Michael, the music we were just listening to was actually on a related theme before we were so rudely interrupted.
Sorry about that.
No, it's not your fault. It's technology. Anyway. So, what were we listening to?
That was the RZA from the Wu-Tang Clan. And that song, like, really dives into a lot of what we're going to talk about tonight with the 5%. A lot of the symbols and the value system. A lot of references a lot of people aren't going to get in that song, but it's too bad we didn't get to.
We could try to play it again. Maybe it won't mess up the second time. Well, they already did here. Let me, we'll put it on as a bed until it gets up to that point again and see if it skips or not. Why don't we do that? That was cut two. One, two. There we go. Here, we'll just listen to it until we get back up to that point again. Well, they already did reference the 9,000 miles, right?
Yeah.
Why don't you tell us about that?
Well, that comes from the Supreme Wisdom Lessons of Master Farad Muhammad, when he was talking about the transatlantic slave trade and saying, you know, why didn't they go back home? And it says they wanted to go back home but they couldn't swim 9,000 miles. And so that physical journey of returning home is allegorized quite often as a mental return to the divine origin that was lost. You know, with the loss of identity, the loss of culture, the loss of the knowledge of self. You know, when you return to that was taken away, that's when you swam your 9,000 miles.
Mm-hmm. And, RZA, R-Z-A,
yeah.
is, he comes out of the Wu-Tang Clan?
Yeah, he's the abbot of the Wu-Tang Clan. He's like the mastermind behind it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, but this track is attributed to him, or?
Yeah, it's a solo track. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And Wu-Tang are adherents of the 5%er movement.
Yeah, all of them at some point or another. Sometimes I've seen identity and affiliation to be somewhat complicated, but at one point or another, it seems all of them have been adherents of the movement.
Mm-hmm. And, well, this is
there
here we are.
Again.
There it is. Let's see. Is there some way to?
You're gonna skip ahead a little bit.
If that's if I knew how to do that, do I know how to do that? No. Now it skips right to the next cut. Okay. You know what we're gonna do? We're going to stop. We're going to eject. We're going to put it in another player and see if it plays any better in the other player. And keep talking in the meanwhile. That was cut two, right? Cut two. There we go. So, this is now your third book.
Yeah, that was the third one.
Yeah. One interesting that all of your books have been in very, very radically different genres, although there's definitely a theme strongly connecting them all.
Yeah, my main thing is just the tradition of indigenous American Islam.
Yes.
You know, wherever Islam goes, you can pour that wine into new bottles. You know what I mean? And the external shape may look different, and maybe the content sometimes is affected too, but, you know, I'm definitely into Islam as something that changes and adapts and gets translated into different cultures. And as an American Muslim, that's my main interest is, you know, my own tradition, my Native American Islamic tradition.
Right, well, that was sort of the spirit of the Sufis who... you know, when Islam was brought to India or to Turkestan or North Africa, they sort of embraced the pre-existing spiritual traditions which were already there as a part of some greater unity with Islam.
Yeah, there was master translators, like cultural translators.
Yes, precisely. So your first book was the Taqwa Corps?
Yeah, that was just a Muslim punk rock novel,
right,
you know.
And sort then, of a Pulp Fiction romance.
Yeah, something like that. And then after that, I was, I decided I wanted to seek out the American Islam out on the road. You know, just go out there and find it in physical space. And so that actually is how I became connected to the 5%ers. I was trying to track down the identity of Master Farad Muhammad, the founder of the Nation of Islam. And I was going into all these different traditions that take their root with him, you know, including the 5%. And, you know, the 5% have a terrible reputation in terms of the way they're portrayed by people like the New York Post and stuff, who basically make them out to be like a violent, you know, mystical black Hell's Angels type of thing. And that's kind of what I was expecting when I went to Harlem for the first time to, like, really build with them. And build is just, you know, any kind of positive
that's
interaction.
That's their lingo, right?
Yeah, it's just become ingrained in me. Like, I just use it without really thinking. But
to build sort of means to connect with somebody and to share knowledge. And
yeah, it's any kind of like positive, you know, positive dialogue.
Yeah.
You know, exchange of information, exchange of perspectives. You know, and the first time I went out there to meet them, I really didn't know what to expect, and I was very intimidated.
Now, out there, meaning up to Harlem.
To Harlem, yeah. To one of their events, mm-hmm. one of their big annual events. And
this was at Harriet Tubman School?
Yeah, this was the Show and Prove, which is like their major annual convention. And just the hospitality that I was treated with, and the friendship and genuine affection, you know. The belief system says that the Caucasian's the devil. You know, in the text, that's what it says.
Which comes out of Elijah Muhammad.
Yeah, it comes out of the Nation of Islam. But that wasn't how I was treated. You know, and You know, Malcolm X talks about his journey to Mecca in Saudi Arabia, where he saw, you know, racism just washed away, and, oh, Muslims don't see color, they love each other, whatever. And that may be what the text says, but I've also been to that Mecca in Saudi Arabia, and I did see racism there. You know, but Harlem, which the 5%ers call Mecca, their text, you could argue that the text is racially antagonistic, but in real life, that's not how it was treated.
Well, I think it's working.
Yeah, it's working now, yeah.
Zigzag, zigzag, arm, leg, leg, arm, head, still puzzle like the jigsaw.
Ever since my birth, I've had no one to care. Ever since my birth, I've had no one to care.
Well, I think we actually did wind up talking over most of it,
yeah.
But I did catch the arm, leg, leg, arm, head reference.
Yeah,
which spells out Allah.
Yeah, that's how the founder of the movement, who his name was Allah, or people affectionately call him the Father, the way that he broke down his name, Allah, arm, leg, leg, arm, head, it signifies the human form. You know, so basically it's, you know, you're not looking up in the clouds for the divine. The divine is in you. Allah is you. You know what I mean? So that's just how, that was just an easy teaching tool for him to explain that to the kids on the street corner, you know, who were his main following when he first started out. It was all like teenagers. And then he would tell them, like, you know, go teach this to someone younger than you. And then they would have to, so you have like 9-year-old 5%ers in the 60s. And that's how they, you know, taught these concepts. Allah was arm, leg, leg, arm, head. Islam was I, self, Lord, and master. Meaning, you know, you don't have to go in the mosque and get a bunch of rules from somebody. You know, Islam is what you make it. It's your way of life.
Okay, so they use the words Allah and Islam,
yeah.
But they actually don't consider themselves Muslim.
Yeah, that's right.
Mm.
I think it was just a natural progression of the culture. You know, I mean, if you look at anything like, you know, Orthodox Islam, Prophet Muhammad started out very much seeing himself in the tradition. I mean, he never really relinquished this, but he saw himself in the tradition of Judaism and Christianity.
Right.
And he wanted to be accepted as such. But when they didn't accept him, it was like, okay, we're going to be our own thing. You know, originally he was praying towards Jerusalem. And then when that didn't really pan out, it was like, okay, we're turning to Mecca. So I think in the 5%, there was also that moment where, you know, the 5%ers were getting it from all sides. You know, the Nation of Islam obviously had beef with them because to them, like the 5% was misappropriating the Nation of Islam lessons. Obviously, it was trouble with the Sunnis. The Sunnis weren't down with arm, leg, leg, arm, head, or anything like that.
Right, of course.
So, you know, there was all these issues with religious Islam, and they weren't really building on the religion. You know, they weren't like, you know, if you're Allah, like how do you submit to Allah? You know what I mean? Who do you pray to if you're Allah? So, you know, the 5% was like, you know, it just became its own tradition. And so logically, Allah the Father, he just said, you know, stop using Muslim names. You know, because a lot of, you know, before that, they had names like Hakim and stuff like that. Stop using Muslim names and stop calling yourselves Muslims because we're gods.
Mm-hmm. So where do they derive their names?
You know, sometimes you still hear those Arabic names, not as often, but primarily, it's just from the supreme alphabets and the supreme mathematics, which are their numerological systems.
Mm-hmm. All right, so well, maybe we should, just by way of background here a little bit, say how you became interested in all this, how you got involved in this. You were researching your second book, which was Blue Eyed Devil,
yeah,
which was your sort of road odyssey through Islamic America. I think that was
the
subtitle,
yeah,
wasn't
yeah,
it? Right,
yeah.
Where you go all across the country and hang with NOI people and Moorish Americans and 5%ers,
right.
And sort of try to untangle the history of how this whole greater milieu developed.
Yeah. Well, I was really interested in the personality of Master Farad Muhammad.
Right.
And he's such a mystery. I mean, he really escaped any kind of, you know, authentic history. Like, he just bounced, you know, off the page. We don't know where he came from. We don't know where he ended up. There's all kinds of stories. And in Blue Eyed Devil, I examine one particular story that has him returning as a Sunni and, you know, helping reform the Nation of Islam.
After having originated as an Ahmadiyya from Pakistan.
Yeah.
Now, you seem to place some credence in this theory.
I can see where there's a relationship to the Ahmadis. You know, I can see that. But in terms of him coming back, you know, it was – I think there's enough convenience.
After disappearing. When did he disappear?
He disappeared in 1934.
And after appearing in 1931?
Yeah, and then he came back in the late 50s.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. According to
Warith Dean, Elijah's son.
Right, mm-hmm.
So, you know, I can see where there's enough things that link up, right, so that it could have been him. It probably wasn't. And I've heard that Warith Dean actually recanted the story at some point, but I haven't seen that documented anywhere that he did that. And the man himself, Muhammad Abdullah, denied that he was Farad.
Mm-hmm.
So he said, like, you know, I taught Warith Dean, so you can say I'm a Farad. I'm not the Farad.
All right, so taught Warith Dean in his youth.
Yeah, there was a time in the 50s when Muhammad Abdullah came to the United States, and Elijah Muhammad appointed him to teach his son, Warith Dean.
Mm-hmm. But taught him Sunni Islam, or?
Yeah, I mean, this guy, I mean, Muhammad Abdullah, he was Ahmadi.
Right.
He was actually Ahmadi, but Elijah Muhammad saw him as qualified to teach his son.
Okay, but to teach his son Sunni Islam, or?
The broader tradition, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So,
because, I mean, you sort of got three distinct trends here. I mean, you've got Sunni, Ahmadiyya, which is this largely Pakistani and Indian so-called Islamic heresy.
Right.
And then you've got Nation of Islam.
Yeah, and they say, you know, after Elijah died, Warith Dean, you know, appointed Muhammad Abdullah to be one of his, you know, main guys reforming the nation.
Right, and moving it towards Sunni Islam.
Towards Sunni Islam.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently this guy, Muhammad Abdullah, by the way, he was of the less heretical, so-called heretical branch of the Ahmadis.
I didn't know there was a less heretical branch.
And the Ahmadis, you know, there's one branch that says its founder was a prophet.
Right.
And then there's one that says he wasn't a prophet.
Uh-huh,
so
uh-huh,
this guy, he didn't call him a prophet.
Mm-hmm,
so he was Sunni enough, I guess.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And he helped Warith Dean reform the nation. And then after he passed away in the early 90s, Warith Dean apparently assembled the inner circle together and said, that was Farad.
Mm-hmm.
It may have been, may have not been. It was a useful story to me at the time. I needed to kind of wrap things together in my own story.
But Warith Dean's organization evolved into something else when it broke with his father's teachings and embraced Sunni Islam.
Warith Dean's ambition was to ultimately dissolve the Nation of Islam.
Right.
And he more or less did that through a series of organizational changes.
Well, it was taken over by Farrakhan, wasn't it?
Well, Warith Dean took over the nation. Louis Farrakhan initially submitted to that, and then over time, as it became less and less like, you know, the father's nation, Elijah Muhammad's nation, Farrakhan broke away in 1978 and said, you know, we're reviving the old school nation.
Right.
Because at this point, the Nation of Islam really no longer existed, so Farrakhan revived it.
Okay, and Warith Dean's organization became known as?
It went through a series of changes, like World Community of Islam in the West.
It still exists.
Yeah, yeah, but it's been very much, like, decentralized over time. That was his ambition.
And he's still alive.
No, he passed away last year, actually.
Oh, last year.
Yeah.
Warith Dean did.
Yep.
Uh-huh.
So his goal was eventually just to have it dissolve into Sunni Islam.
Mm-hmm.
And for the most part, it's done that. But
right.
it's still a very unique community.
Mm-hmm. Well, it keeps certain remnants of the old Elijah Muhammad nomenclature and so on.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I've gone to congregational prayers with them, and you'll hear references to Elijah. You'll hear the language, like grafted and things like that. It's non-racial, and it's fully, you know, theologically in line with Sunni Islam.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But they just see all this as part of their heritage.
Mm-hmm. All right, so the other extremely enigmatic figure who was instrumental in setting this whole cultural current in motion even earlier than Farid Muhammad was the noble Drew Ali.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I mean, people have made the connection saying that Farad was, or Elijah, or both, were members of the Moorish Science Temple, fully possible. I mean, at least, like, you know, if you look at what was going on in Detroit and Chicago, like, I could very easily see all this as just being a soup, you know, that someone could just pull different
right.
things out of.
Right.
So whether they were official members or not really isn't totally relevant, you know. But Noble Drolley was definitely probably the father of this tradition. Or, I mean, you know, you could actually go back and talk about how he was influenced by Marcus Garvey and, you know, there's really no beginning. But Noble Drolley definitely, you know, and there's things in Noble Drolley where...
Look, some of the contemporary Moorish Americans, as they call themselves, consider Marcus Garvey to have been the harbinger of the prophet.
The John the Baptist figure. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah.
Noble Drolley, you know, he taught that God was your higher self and the devil was your lower self. So that, I mean, when you look at the 5% saying arm, leg, leg, arm, head, like there's a root, you know, there's a historical connection. There's something that binds all this together. Even though these groups, these cultures, they have profound differences, you know, very profound arguments, but you can see it being family.
And if you want to take it back even further, there is the apocryphal story that Noble Drolley was half Cherokee or was raised by the Cherokees. And there's talk of, you know, these triracial isolate communities made up of Cherokees and escaped slaves who might have been Muslim from West Africa.
Yeah, the Ben Ishmaels.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
And again, it's like there's, you know, with Noble Drolley, I mean, it's really, I would say it's impossible to get any kind of concrete evidence
sure
on him.
Yeah.
But the stories matter.
But it's certainly interesting material for conjecture.
Definitely.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay, so where in this whole lineage did the 5%ers emerge?
Okay, so the 5% starts in the 1960s at the Nation of Islam's Harlem chapter. Now, this was around the time that Malcolm split from the Nation. And a lot of people, you know, this is a chaotic time in Harlem's Muslim community, because when Malcolm went overseas, he did so as a follower of Elijah Muhammad. He was out of the organization, but he was very much...
When he took Hajj.
Yeah, he was very much a believer in Elijah Muhammad. And then when he went to Mecca, you know, the story is that he experienced this transcendent racial, transracial brotherhood and disowned the Nation. But when he went on the plane, people didn't know where he stood. You know, and a lot of people saw this conflict of Malcolm being much more into action than Elijah was. You know, Malcolm talked about the ballot or the bullet, and Elijah disavowed both of those. Elijah Muhammad, you know, for him, the answer was moral purification, discipline, you know, bringing the community together, and living a godly life, you know, and building up an economic base. And you know, Malcolm was very much into direct action. So a lot of people in the Nation of Islam are people who, for whatever reason, were out of the organization but still believed in the lessons and stuff. They saw Malcolm as a way of manifesting Elijah Muhammad's message, you know, in real life, you know, beyond the dietary rules and, you know, wearing the bow ties and things like that. So the 5%ers... They kind of fit in the middle of all that. Like, they were kind of a third party in this dispute. And at one point, there were kids who thought that Malcolm X was the group's leader. But the actual...
Well, I thought that Malcolm was the...
They thought that Malcolm was the 5%'s leader. Hmm. You know, just because, I mean, these are kids on the street. And like, you know, it's all oral
right.
tradition, you
right.
know. So...
Which, of course, there was no truth to at all.
Right, right. But this individual, his name in the Nation was Clarence 13X.
Mm-hmm.
And
In the NOI.
And, and during this time, he kind of bounced back and forth. Like, the FBI observed him hanging out with Malcolm's group. They observed him going to Nation of Islam rallies, even after he left the Nation. And ultimately, he took the Nation's teachings and began spreading them on the street to kids who weren't in the mosque and teaching them that they were gods, because that's what the Nation of Islam said. They were gods. And that's just... swelled into its own community. You know, all these kids who were out of the mosque just taking these lessons and building on them. And it's really important to look at the Nation of Islam's concept of godhood. You know, the Nation of Islam said that all black men were gods, but that one man was the best knower, and that was Allah. And Allah was the master fraud, Muhammad. Now, when they said that, you know, all black men are gods and one's named Allah, they weren't saying you can shoot lightning out of your fingertips. You know what I mean? It was very much a materialist, I would say almost atheist, view of divinity. Because the idea is that there's no mystery God. You know, this God, this unseen, non-existent God is used to oppress people. So you just got to take it upon yourself.
Well, Elijah said that.
Yeah, you just got to take it upon yourself to change your environment and obtain the justice that you've been deprived of. So,
and yet there's a mystical element to it.
I mean, yeah, there is.
Like
there
Western
is.
Rational atheism.
With a lot of the 5% today, I would say it's closer to that.
Oh, yeah?
It's closer to that, yeah. But basically, this man, whose name at the time was Clarence, he said, look, you know, I'm Allah. You know, I'm the best knower. I'm the one who's mastered these lessons. And he went out and taught that to the kids. And eventually he gave them that power, too. He said, you're Allah also. All of you are Allah. And yeah, you know, there has been some mysticism. I can't say it's totally anti-mystical, but I would say the direction that the community has gone in today is anti-mystical. You know, I mean, for me, I'm a Muslim. I get interested in this, and my instinct is to reconcile it to, you know, Ibn Arabi, classical Persian Sufism, and you know, different things that talk about the divinity within. And, you know, I can build with 5%ers on that. But a lot of times the response I get is, you know, that's peace, but, you know, we don't deal in abstract things. You know, we don't deal in, like, you know, there's nothing like we're, you know, God is within us. We are God. You know, there's nothing to manifest. There's nothing to be incarnate. You know, it's like, that's just, you know, I'm God. Like, that's where they're at. But, you know, it's a diverse community with no central authority. So you're going to hear lots. I mean, there's 5%ers who say that they're Muslim. You know, and that's really frowned upon today in the community. But there's some who will make that argument. And it's a pretty weak argument, but they'll go there.
All right, why don't you talk about Clarence 13X, who became Allah? What was his lineage? What was his trip?
His trip basically was that he scienced out the lessons. And here's the thing, like, today, you know, you hear a lot of critique of the Nation of Islam coming from the 5%, that the nation isn't really faithful to its own lessons. Because the lessons say, you know, there's no mystery God.
Mm-hmm.
The lessons say the only God is man.
Right.
The original man, the black man, the father of civilization, God of the universe. So, you know, Allah, you know, the former Clarence, like, he was almost a fundamentalist of the lessons. Because, you know, it's basically like, okay, if there's no mystery God, then who are you praying to? Because the nation prays. You know, so who are you praying to? And you'll hear that debate today between the 5% and the NOI. But that was basically where this guy was at. Like, he really just got deep into the lessons, found an interpretation of it that didn't really match what he saw going on in the mosque or in the rhetoric from the mosque. And so he just went out and said, look, you know, that's me. Like, if the black man is God, why am I praying to this, you know, half black man whose picture's on the wall? You know what I mean? Like, that doesn't...
Meaning Fard.
Yeah, like that doesn't make sense.
Mm-hmm.
So he went out, and, you know, all these kids who were willing to put that power on him, you know, he said, no, that's on you. Like, everything you're going to put on my shoulders, I'm putting on yours. You know, you're Allah, you're Allah, you're Allah. You know, all that's within you.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and he went from the depths of being incarcerated as criminally insane to the heights of... sharing the cover of Time magazine with Mayor John Lindsay.
Yeah, there was a public incident. There was a public disturbance on, I believe it was 7th Avenue. And he was found unable to understand the charges against him. Like, they said, like, he swung a stick at somebody's head or something, and the cops came and he resisted arrest, allegedly.
And this is, like, what, 68?
65.
60, that early, 65. Yeah.
And they said he was unable to understand the charges, which really benefited the FBI's cause, which was, you know, the FBI was deeply involved with this. You know, it's in their declassified
and
files.
And you did FOIAs to get all this?
Yeah, it's all out there.
FBI files?
Hoover was somewhat interested in the case. The FBI, the judge found Allah to be, you know, mentally ill, which, you know, here's again, it's like you have to understand their belief system. Like, he called himself Allah, you know, in a very reasoned way based on this intellectual tradition that he was working with. It wasn't, you know, I created the universe and I can, like, you know, create floods and stuff. Yeah, yeah, like, it wasn't, but they didn't realize that. And when he stood in court and said, I'm a law, they didn't get the political point of that. They didn't get, like, you know, that as a voice of resistance. Like, they're like, oh, you're crazy.
Right.
So they put him in a hospital that was basically a prison.
Like you're Napoleon.
Yeah, and for him to be found mentally ill and unable to understand the charges really benefited the FBI because they could keep him there as long as they wanted
to. Where exactly was he?
This was Matteawan State Hospital for the Criminally Insane, which is in downstate New York, sort of Fishkill today. They could hold him there for as long as he needed to, you know, as long as they needed him there, because there wasn't a fixed sentence. He wasn't convicted of a crime. So it wasn't like, oh, we sentence you to 5 years. It's like, oh, you're going to be here until your community disappears. And it never disappeared. But
so how long was he actually?
He was there for almost 2 years. Mm-hmm. And when he was brought back out on the street, this was at a time when Mayor Lindsay was trying to engage the actual leaders on the street, you know, to prevent race riots and build with the community and stuff like that. So he was saying, like, you know, maybe the real authorities in the black neighborhoods aren't the elected officials. Maybe it's just some guy that everybody respects. Maybe it's a preacher. Maybe, you know, in one case it was a numbers runner named Bumpy Johnson, you know. And Allah was seen as one of those guys who, if he says riot, everybody's going to riot. And if he says don't riot, they're not going to riot. Like one of those voices of authority. Mm-hmm. So he went, you know, he sent people to Allah to build with him. And it started out real simple with, like, you know, the city would provide bus trips for the 5%ers to the beach, things like that. Plane rides, you know, free tickets to the movie theater.
Plane rides to where?
It was just like an exciting thing, like just, you know, flying for an hour over the city.
Uh-huh.
You know, for these kids who've never been on a plane before.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Allah's real desire was to have his own school. And this, you know, there were all kinds of like street academies at the time funded by the city. And so they made that happen, and he had his own school with the Urban League. And, you know, it was a mixed success for, you know.
Teaching 5% doctrine.
Well, the idea was to help kids get their GEDs or high school diplomas, then move into
like a. There was some 5% doctrine mixed in with it.
It was definitely present. Mm-hmm. It was definitely present. Mm-hmm. And that was one of the reasons why the school didn't really work out. Partly, I mean, there were all these different, you know, voices trying to determine what that school was going to be. Sometimes it was big corporate sponsors. Sometimes it was the NYPD, which would send cops to come in and, like, you know, listen to the rhetoric. And one school, not 5% are related, but one school was actually closed down for that reason because of the rhetoric, you know, that they were hearing. So there are all these different people trying to interfere. The guy who ran the program was a white Christian who originally saw it as a way to, like, you know, bring salvation to the ghetto, you know. He actually authored a book called The Gospel in the Ghetto. And so there are all these different people trying to interfere with the school. And Allah didn't feel like college prep was really the way to go. He felt like these kids needed vocational training, you know, and he felt like they needed something more practical for the life they were living, you know, on the street. And so eventually the school just became basically a 5%er hangout or a place where they can do their own teaching on their lessons. And that's basically the level on which it exists today. It's still there. But they do a lot of cool, like, after-school programs and things like that.
It's still there.
Yep.
It's called
still
what?
There. The Allah School in Mecca.
Mm-hmm. And of which there is a picture in your book, right?
Yeah, yep.
Your book being The 5%ers, Islam, Hip Hop, and the Gods of New York by Michael Muhammad Knight from One World Publishers in Oxford, UK. And we are speaking with Michael Muhammad Knight on the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade with me, Bill Weinberg, at 12:33 in the a.m. A listener-supported non-commercial WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City. All right, so then MLK is assassinated.
And, you know, this was a moment at which, you know, Lindsay felt that someone white had to go into Harlem and face that anger, face that pain. And he went into Harlem. He you know, contacted the 5%ers, contacted the law. And the 5%ers basically served as his escorts on a march, you know, just an unplanned march through the city out of respect for Dr. King. And this was a really transformative moment for the 5%, because up to this point they were really demonized. And I mean, we didn't get into all like the media speculation and rumors about what they were about. I mean, they were accused of trying to kill the Pope, blow up the Statue of Liberty. They were accused of being tied to Chinese communists, like all these crazy stuff. And, you know, at this point, they're marching with the mayor with a request that everyone respect Dr. King's message of nonviolence. And so while other cities across the country were burning to the ground, New York was relatively unharmed. And the 5%ers were widely publicly recognized for that. And the law was seen as a positive community leader. So this was a huge transformation for them, you know, like he definitely was on his way to becoming part of the system, you know.
And was on the cover of a Time magazine,
New York magazine,
yeah. Sorry.
And, but, you know, a year after that, he was assassinated himself.
Right. Now, how did that happen? What was that all about?
Basically, the details of the assassination, he was in an elevator and someone shot him. Mm-hmm. You know, we don't really have a lot more than that.
Hmm.
But,
what's the conjecture?
But in terms of conjecture, like, fingers were pointed at everybody because he was teaching an anti-drug message when there were tons of drug dealers on the street. He was teaching, you know, Nation of Islam lessons in his own interpretation and without the nation's permission. So people said that, you know, the Nation of Islam was responsible for it. Especially, I mean, this is 4 years after Malcolm. So, you know, there were people saying that. And then there were
4 years after Malcolm was killed.
So, and then there were also people saying that Allah was somehow a threat to the government, which at that point, he was very deeply entrenched in the New York City government, and his foreign policy views were actually somewhat right-wing. So,
how so?
He was very much for the Vietnam War.
Oh.
Very much about the Vietnam War. And
on what grounds, especially if rumors had him mixed up with Chinese communists?
Yeah, I mean, I guess that throws that out the window. You know, that rumor. But yeah, he believed that people who were protesting the Vietnam War were sent by Russia to undermine America. So his foreign policy views were very right wing.
Hmm.
You know, I actually say this in the book. He would be on the right side of George Bush, you know, today, if he was alive. But you know, and even his social views were somewhat conservative. I mean, that
he would have in common with the NOI. I mean, they're very socially conservative.
Yeah, I mean, but his views on the death, he was very pro-death penalty. Mm-hmm. He believed in the right of police officers to shoot without provocation.
Well, I can see that living, you know, in an atmosphere of violent crime and all that. I mean, it sort of makes a certain degree of political sense, even if we completely disagree with it. But the pro-Vietnam War thing just doesn't compute, you know?
Yeah. I mean, this is a tough thing. I mean, people wrestle with that. And, you know, because the Nation of Gods and Earths, the 5% today, it's very conscious, very not on that page at all.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's difficult to reconcile when the founder of this tradition, you know, wasn't necessarily on the same level as everybody today.
Mm-hmm.
But so there are some people who retroactively go back and say, yeah, the government wanted him dead. Hoover wanted him dead. Nixon wanted him dead. You know, whoever. You know, I really can't get into that because at that point, he was so much in the system and so much, you know, he was a cheerleader for Lindsay. And, you know, I don't see what he was exactly threatening to at that particular time.
Right, this is still 68 when he was killed.
69. Summer 69. Of 69.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. It was just the 40th anniversary just recently.
Mm-hmm.
But, so, I mean, there's some people who go there and say the government killed him.
Mm-hmm.
Again, you know, I can't really get into that. But yeah, it's been unsolved. Nobody knows who did it. I mean, it could have been a simple, like, street beef. It could have been, you know, he was shooting dice that night. It could have been over the fact that he wanted dice. You know, I don't know. But there was no conviction.
Mm-hmm.
And the police didn't seem particularly interested in solving it either. So,
what happened to the movement after that?
It was dormant for maybe a year or so, and then, you know, these kids who knew him started passing on those lessons to a younger batch of kids. You know, you have some 15-year-old kid who knew the guy and teaches his 9-year-old brother, you know, and it just started, like, it spread. And in the 70s, it just, you know, it was just an amazing expansion, not only within New York, not only was it a revival within New York, but, you know, some of these 5%ers, you know, went to college and they taught on their campuses, you know, some as far away as California. And then others were incarcerated, and the teaching spread throughout the prison system, you know. And then by the time that, like, by the time that hip-hop started rolling around, it was so entrenched as, like, just the culture of New York City that these MCs were, like, using those lessons, using that language, using the message in their music, and then it just, like, launched all over the world. So now it's completely a worldwide culture. You know, I've heard of gods and earths in Africa, Europe. I always hear rumors that they're in China and Japan. I haven't been able to confirm that. But
okay, gods and earths.
Yeah.
You might want to explain a little bit about that.
Well, basically, it's a very traditional view of divinity as, you know, sky god, sky father and earth mother. But instead of praying to abstract symbols, abstract concepts, they see themselves as that the man is the sky father and the woman is the earth mother. That's basically how I would break it down. But the woman is mother of civilization, she's the earth, and you know, the man is God. You know.
And there's been a certain effort recently to for women in the movement to start thinking of themselves as goddesses.
There's a lot of debate about that, and it's kind of an interesting place right now in the movement's history, because I think with any religion, and they don't call themselves a religion, I use that term for them in an academic way, but you know, it's a religion. It is a religion. You see a codification happen over time. I mean, if you look at early Islam, there was vigorous debate over the Quran. What was its nature? You know, was it created or uncreated? Was it even complete? Were there parts missing? And then over time, you see those debates becoming less and less possible. And today, you couldn't have that debate. In Christianity, you see, you know, in the early centuries, there was all kinds of debate about the nature of Jesus.
Sure.
You know, and then once it gets cemented, then, okay, no more discussion.
Right.
And I think that's happening right now in the Nation of Gods and Earths, is that there has been debate about the goddess issue, and it still comes up. And also the Muslim, non-Muslim issue, you know, are Muslims, are gods Muslims, vice versa. I think it's really getting to a point now where you can't even have that conversation.
All right, so the congealing doctrine is that they are not Muslim.
That they're not Muslim, that women are not gods or goddesses. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. They're the earth. Mm-hmm. And
okay, they're not Muslim, and yet they call themselves Allah, and Islam, standing for...
Thyself, Lord and Master.
Thyself, Lord and Master, is one of their catchphrases. Harlem is Mecca, and Queens is Medina, is that it?
Brooklyn is Medina. Queens is the desert.
Yeah. Right. And Bronx is the Isle of Patmos.
Pelon, yep. That's the other name for it, Pelon. Yep.
And Staten Island?
Savior's Island.
Savior's Island.
Yeah.
And who is the Savior?
It's the man. You know what I mean? Like, you are your own Savior. You know, you can't look to the sky for your Savior.
Mm-hmm.
So it's all in self.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, so in the Supreme Alphabets, the letter S means Savior or self.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's really the same meaning for them.
And what are the Supreme Alphabets?
Supreme Alphabets is a system basically in which each letter has an attribute. You know, it's something that, I mean, you can see different Sufis throughout Islamic history doing that. I mean, I don't say there's a direct influence. There's no evidence of that. But it's, you know, they do that with the numbers. It's just standard numerology. Each item has a particular attribute.
And this emerged with the five percenters?
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
So that's not in the in the Nation of Islam?
No.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and where does the term five percenters come from, and to what does it refer?
Well, in Master Farad's teaching, you know, the original man is God. But only 5% of people recognize this. 85% of the people are deaf, dumb, and blind. They believe in an unseen mystery God that's up in the clouds. And this is a tool of oppression on them by the 10% who are basically the ruling class. So you have the slave makers of the poor, the bloodsuckers, the 10%, enslaving 85% with these false religions. And then the 5% are the ones who see their own divinity. They're basically intellectual freedom fighters. You know, they're trying to liberate the 85.
All right, now this does come out of the NOI.
Yeah, this is the NOI. And the NOI naturally saw itself as the 5%.
Right.
But, you know, there was this critique that they weren't really living out the lessons. And so the 5%ers were then, in a way, the 5% of the 5%. And I've heard 5%ers today say, hey, you know, within the 5% of the 5%, there's also a 5, 10, and 85. And that's just the nature of group behavior.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Okay, and another point of diversion with the NOI was they're less rigid in the racialist aspect of the doctrine. Would you agree with that?
I would say that the 5%ers gave me an access that I couldn't have had with the NOI necessarily. I think the doors were open that I could potentially have that access with the NOI at some point, but with the 5%, it was just automatically just respect, friendship, love. It was peace.
Mm-hmm. And there is this controversial figure in the group. You've got a whole chapter dedicated to him.
Azrael?
Yes.
Azrael, yep. And Azrael actually... okay, so Azrael was basically the pioneer white 5%er. He was a 17-year-old kid who got arrested for stealing a car in the 60s. And they considered him to be mentally ill, so they put him in Mattawan. And it was there, after horrific treatment by the guards, that he met Allah. And Allah said, you are a righteous man. And this was a definite break from the Nation of Islam. Because Elijah Muhammad said, white people could know righteousness, but they cannot be righteous. So for Allah to tell this kid, you are a righteous man, was a definite split. And, you know, it could be speculated that Allah, seeing this kid in this horrific hell of a prison... it complicated his own views on inequality and race and the social construction of race because, you know, black man is God, white man is a devil. I mean, to me, that makes perfect sense in American history. You know, for what a man like Allah witnessed in his life, it makes perfect sense to me. But perhaps when he was in this prison and he saw this white kid who was not receiving white privilege, you know, maybe that made things more complicated. Mm-hmm. And maybe he... factored in things like class and stuff like that. So he taught this kid he was a righteous man, and he made him Azrael, the death angel. And Azrael is now in his 60s or nearing 60, and he's very much in the movement still. And he took me under his wing, and I was his student. So
where is Azrael today?
You know, I actually don't know. Mm. And I've made numerous trips to the law school.
Where did you hang with him?
I hung out with him at the law school, and we actually... We did some traveling together.
Hmm.
We drove from Harlem to Milwaukee and back. We were just living in my car and stuff. And he gave me his name. He named me Azrael Wisdom. Wisdom in the mathematics is the number 2. So I'm like Azrael 2.
Azrael the second.
Azrael the second.
Mm-hmm.
And
where does the term Azrael come from? Is that
that's the Islamic angel of death.
Mm-hmm.
And Allah basically told this kid that, you know, it's your job to get the evildoers. You know, because Azrael, he's like this liminal figure because he can travel in white society at a time when most of the 5%ers could not. So Azrael, there's a story that Allah gave him the keys to heaven and hell. So this white kid can pass in and out of heaven and hell, meaning like, you know, the social construction of whiteness. He passes in and out. Sometimes he's white and sometimes he's not. So, he's a liminal figure. He's on the margin.
Mm-hmm. And when you say it's the Islamic angel of death, I mean, that's in Orthodox
Islam. This is
Islam, traditional
Islam.
Mm-hmm. All right, and the other point of divergence with the NOI, perhaps more controversial, is at least in their early days, they did not share the anti-drug orthodoxy.
Yeah, and you know, I've heard stories where early 5%ers broke down their name as they were the 5% of Muslims who drank and smoked. You know, and that didn't last.
That was facetious? Or?
This was in the early 60s. I mean, but Allah himself indulged a little bit, you know.
In what?
Cocaine and weed, which, you know, he called weed equality. That still lasts. That's still, you know, if you ever hear God say he builds an equality, you know, it may mean equality and it may mean equality. So, but yeah, he maintained a pretty emphatic anti-drug message in terms... I mean, he forbade heroin. You know, he was definitely, he forbade heroin.
Allah did.
Yeah, yeah, Allah forbade heroin. And I think if he was alive during the crack epidemic, he would have forbidden crack also. But, you know, and there's different interpretations of his lifestyle. You know, some gods say that that's how he reached kids. You know, that's how, like, he communicated with kids on the street. He wasn't coming at them in some pious, you know, very, like, you know, big gestures of righteousness. He was on the street. He rolled dice. He liked girls a lot, apparently. And, you know, he smoked reefer sometimes.
All right, well, let's see. We've got 10 more minutes. That'll take us to 1 o'clock in the morning, at which point I think maybe we'll take a little musical break. And I've got a couple of announcements and little rants to give. And then we could consider taking listener phone calls, if that's what we decided we wanted to do, and people actually call in. Or we could just keep on talking amongst ourselves. Also, depending on how long my rants go, because I do have some stuff I need to briefly put out to the listeners regarding world politics and WBAI politics. But let's try to wrap it up and bring it to the present day. Who were the first rappers who got on board with the 5%ers?
Well, it really goes back to the beginning of rap because, you know, hip-hop's a New York phenomenon. So, you know, when hip-hop was starting, like, the 5% were so deeply ingrained and deeply involved. So I think in terms of, on the national stage, you know, world's famous Supreme Team was one of the big early ones. Most of the real prolific, well-known 5% MCs were in kind of the golden age, like the early 90s, like the Wu-Tang Clan, Brand Nubian, you know, lots of MCs just like, you know, not even all of them who were officially, you know, so-called officially affiliated with the movement, but still using the language, like Nas. Like, if you listen to Nas, like, he's using the language quite a bit, but I don't know if he was ever actually a 5%er. You know, it was just part of the culture on the
right.
street.
Right. I mean, you mentioned a lot of rappers in the book, and it's not always clear which ones were part of the movement and which ones were just sort of using the lingo.
Yeah, I mean, it was definitely part of the cultural landscape at that time. It was dominant. You know, there was no way of avoiding it. Rakim, very important MC. I like Rakim because sometimes he gets esoteric on it. You know, like, you don't even... If you aren't familiar with the language, you're going to have no idea what he's talking about. Like, no idea. Like, you know, his song, The Mystery, if you're not familiar with the 5% language, if you don't know who God is and who the earth is, and he's talking about, like, you know, God choosing the third planet to start new life and stuff like that, you know, it's like you're just completely out of the loop. You don't know what he's saying.
Well, but, I mean, that's sort of the more traditional notion of God as this distant creator
being.
Well,
that's the thing. Like, he's in the mystery, like, he's talking about who is God. And so he's unraveling this mystery throughout the song. And when he's saying, you know, God chose a third planet and brought life there, and, you know, the words, you know, he let off his resources in the water, you know, that may sound very Judeo-Christian Islamic.
But
that's his parents. He's talking about his parents.
Ah.
You know what I mean? So, but if you don't know, you're not going to know. Like, he doesn't make it plain. It's for the initiated.
All right. Now, where is the movement at today? It continues to exist and to thrive?
Yeah, definitely. And it continues to evolve. You know, like I said, you know, it's becoming codified. They don't call themselves a religion. I would say it's a religion. It's a great religion. It's a cool religion. But, you know, it's a religion. And it's becoming codified. There's a developing orthodoxy, and the discourse is narrowing a little bit. But it's also becoming much more intellectual.
Well, I mean, very frequently when the founder dies, you know, you can think of examples from, you know, Noble Drew and Elijah Muhammad, or
right.
Swami Prabhupada, or the Hare Krishnas. Usually there's a sort of a fragmentation of the movement which follows. But you're saying that hasn't happened?
Well, because there was no official head after him, and he basically gave that power to everybody. So he really prevented a schism. And you'll see differences of interpretation, but not official, we're on this side, you're on that side. And there is a certain authority vested in the kids who knew him, you know, some of whom were called the firstborn, nine of whom were called the firstborn, and the different elders who said, oh, Allah taught me this, Allah taught me that. But really, it's so decentralized. You know, it's I, self, Lord, and master. I mean, it's very hard to, like, create a structure around that. Some try. I mean, they have tried. But it develops pretty organically.
Okay, so You're about to, can we talk about you a little bit?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, so can you want to tell the audience what you're about to do, what the next phase in your life is?
Oh, the next phase is marriage and grad school.
At?
At Harvard Divinity.
Amazing.
Islamic studies.
Uh-huh. Do you have your sights on a new book eventually?
Eventually, yeah. I mean, I actually have a new book that I just sent in the final edits for today.
Uh-huh.
And that's about my travels last year. I went to Pakistan, Syria, Egypt, Ethiopia, and I made Hajj in Saudi Arabia.
Last year,
yep, mm-hmm. all last year. And, you know, I was carrying around these American traditions with me, and I was trying to find a definition of Islam that was essential and was common to all these different things I was engaging. But, you know, I really found that, like, Islam on the ground, it's not Islam in the clouds. You know, it's what people make it to be. So I was walking around with supreme mathematics in my head. You know, when I was going to Mecca, and when I was going to Ethiopia and Pakistan, you know, building on Master Farad stuff, because I'm an American Muslim. So it all just got jumbled up for me. It all, like, it's all my source material.
So how long were you on the road?
On and off, like, most, maybe like a third or fourth of the year. But, I mean, it was spread out. It wasn't all one trip.
Hmm. Where in Ethiopia?
Harar. Hmm. Which, used, you know, they call it the fourth holiest city in Islam. Nobody gives them that because, you know, nobody's going to give an African country anything in Islam. You know what I mean? Sorry, Malcolm, you know, but no fairy tales there. You know
what I mean? All right, so forgive my ignorance. And what is its claim to being the fourth holiest city in Islam?
Just that there's so many saints, so many shrines and mosques. There's like 100 mosques in a very small town.
Hmm.
So, and
Muhammad was never there.
No, there's no, like, I mean, you know, the early Muslims were in Ethiopia, but there's no connection to this particular city. It was basically, you know, they just built a wall to protect it from Christian tribes, and they had all these saints that were buried there, and it just...
Muslim saints.
Yeah, Muslim saints, and it just became understood that this was a very Islamic city. So, but it was deep, you know. I had a lot of crazy times, you know. It was a pretty deep trip.
So who's publishing the book?
That's Soft Skull.
Great, Press, and what's it going to be called?
Journey to the End of Islam.
Wow.
And it's basically, you know, I was searching for a definition, and I felt like I had reached the end of definitions. So it wasn't the end of Islam in my life, or certainly the end of the historical phenomenon, but the end of me being able to say, this is Islam, that is not Islam.
All right, so you were in, Ethiopia, Syria, Pakistan, Egypt.
Pakistan, and then I went to Saudi.
Sudan?
Nope, never made it to Sudan.
So you flew over Sudan?
I flew over, yeah. I had a chance when I was planning my layover. Like, I could have gone to Khartoum or I could have gone to Cairo, mm-hmm. and I chose Cairo because I wanted to see the pyramids.
Right,
and stuff.
Right, and Al-Azhar, I suppose.
Yeah, I didn't get to see Al-Azhar, but Imam Hussein's head. I went to shrines of Imam Hussein's head in Cairo and Damascus, and I don't know which one was real, but I went to both of them just to cover all the bases.
Imam Hussein's head.
Yeah. Yep. Prophet Muhammad's grandson.
Literally his head.
Literally his head. I mean, you don't get to see it, mm-hmm. but. But, you know, there's people who say it's in Cairo, and there's people who say it's in Damascus.
Hmm.
So I just made sure to get to both of them.
Hmm. Well, he was killed in contemporary Iraq, right?
Yeah, Iraq, yeah.
So how did his head wind up in either Cairo or Damascus?
Well, Damascus was where the guy who was basically on the other side of that battle.
Right.
You know, Yazid. That's where his office, you could say, was.
Mm-hmm.
So the head was brought as a trophy there.
Uh-huh, right. That makes perfect sense.
But in Cairo, there was... This was when Egypt was ruled by the Fatimids,
right.
who claimed descent from the Prophet's daughter,
mm-hmm.
Imam Hussein's mother.
Right.
And so their opponents were saying, you're not really descended from Fatima. You know, you got nothing. You're frauds. So to build credibility, they started establishing all these special shrines all over Egypt. And then miraculously around this time that you had this political struggle over credibility in the Shia tradition, they find Imam Hussein's head. And they establish it at their, you know, they make a shrine to the head in their political capital, Cairo.
So you visited both?
Yep,
both of these shrines.
Yeah.
Wow.
It's the same vibe, so the moral was like it didn't really matter which one was real.
And then I guess you must have flown over Iran.
I think when I went to Pakistan, I flew over Iran.
Right, exactly.
I actually wanted to go to Iran.
And you didn't go to Iraq or Afghanistan?
No. I wanted to go to Iraq.
What were your impressions of Mecca? And where else did you go in Saudi Arabia? Just Mecca?
Mecca and Medina.
Just Mecca and Medina.
And it was, you know, it was self-annihilating. Like, it was a really intense experience. But people are still people, you know. And I think that's a hard thing for a lot of pilgrims to deal with. When you go to Mecca and it's like human beings are still human beings. You know, like one of the guys I was with was offered weed. You know, like 50 yards away from the Haram, from the Kaaba.
In Mecca?
Yeah, in Mecca. And, you know, he was
people weren't smoking it openly in the street,
No, but, I mean, he was in an alley trying to buy a SIM card, and you know, he's this dude, he's like, do you have a SIM card? And the guy's like, I have whatever you want. You want weed? I mean, you shouldn't buy your SIM cards in an alley. But there was this kid there, and the young kid was like, weed, there's weed in Mecca, you know? And it was like this was, you know,
There's Starbucks in Mecca.
Yeah, there's Starbucks. Like, right outside the Prophet's tomb, there's Starbucks. I was looking at the Haram in Mecca from Burger King, you know, right through the window. There's the Haram, so... You know, so much for the clash of civilizations idea.
Well, yeah, but to me, this sort of really symbolizes the whole, whole polarized jihad versus GWAT, mm-hmm. Jihad versus McWorld duality, right? You know, because, I mean, this is fueling the whole Wahhabist, Salafist backlash within Islam.
And that Islam itself is Saudi globalization, that particular Wahhabist Islam.
Yeah, and yet the Saudis, who were ostensibly sponsoring it, are bringing in Starbucks and Burger King, you know?
It's like the royals are basically creating the critique against them.
Exactly.
Because they promote this Wahhabism, but you can't be a Wahhab and have 300 wives. You can't be a Wahhab and go, like, you know, have a gold bathtub and gamble all your money away in European casinos.
Well, you can have multiple wives.
Well, not 300.
Right.
they put limits on that.
Yes, yes, yes.
But so the ideology that is the foundation for Saudi Arabia is also the critique against Saudi Arabia.
Exactly.
So, you know, I mean...
Very, very contradictory situation.
Yeah. I mean, that's something's going to happen there at some point. It's just a matter of time.
All right, and now it's 1 o'clock in the morning on listener-supported non-commercial WBAI 99.5 FM here in New York City. This is the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade. My name is Bill Weinberg. We're speaking with Michael Muhammad Knight, author of The Five Percenters, Islam, Hip Hop, and the Gods of New York, and the forthcoming, what's the title going to be again?
Journey to the End of Islam.
Journey to the End of Islam from?
Soft Skull.
From Soft Skull. So you've got, what, four different books now from four different publishers,
actually, this
right?
is six now. Journey to the Sixth. I have another novel, Osama Van Halen.
My goodness, you've certainly been busy.
I have a memoir called
Osama Van Halen?
Yeah, and that's got, like, you know, taco cores in it. It's got Matt Damon getting kidnapped by a Shia skinhead. And then I have a memoir just about, you know, just being a crazy teenage convert. Impossible Man, it's called. That came out this year.
Really?
Yep.
Well, I am going to prevail upon you to get me a copy of the new one, the forthcoming
one. Okay.
When you come down to visit from Boston, we'll get you on the radio to talk about it again.
Thank you.
Meanwhile, why don't we hear Rakim and the Mystery and then decide what we want to do with the remaining half hour. I do have some hopefully short rants about world politics and WBAI politics. So hopefully they won't take too long. Let's hear Rakim.
If you can see it, we can solve the mystery. The answer revolves around your history. So carefully, I drop this degree. Scientifically and realistically, if you can see it, you can solve the mystery. The answer revolves around your history. So carefully, I drop this degree. Scientifically and realistically. An eternal blackness in the midst of the darkest night. Proteins and minerals exist within specks of light. Solids, liquids, and gases and sparks of light within infinite lengths and widths and depths and heights. No beginning or ending. With seven dimensions, enough space for more than a million worlds and inventions. To travel through time with enough room to be the wound of the Most High's great mind, which he would soon make shine. With intelligent elements and sight that he would gather. In the realms of relativity, electricity struck matter. And energies explode, he will load to keep releasing atoms by the millions to the number.
numbers increased until it was burning. He kept returning himself to the source. The hotter his thoughts, it gave the center more force. He gave birth to the sun, which would follow his laws. All caused by his mental intercourse. Who saw? If you can see it, we can solve the mystery. The answer revolves around your history. So carefully, I drop this degree, scientifically and realistically. His craft, the master in the attic. He dealt with measurements. His language was mathematics. His theoretical wisdom or the numerical system. The complete number nine, which means born or existing. He gave birth to all planets, inorganic and organic. So you wouldn't take it for granted. They rotate at their own distance around the sun and fully submit to the existence of one. And each one was promised everlasting perfection. If each one keeps spinning in the same direction to the east, and each speak the motion of peace and harmony, and each show devotion to teach the universes to come. The whole world must go according. All your galaxies are more broad, your stars start falling. So stay in your orbit, maintain safe and sound like the planets. Your cycle remains perfectly round. If you can, see if you can solve the mystery. The answer revolves around your history. So carefully, I drop this degree, scientifically and realistically.
Let's go.
In his wisdom, his response is this, a understanding, which is the best part. He picked the third planet where new forms of life would start. He pursued, show and prove every move in order. Back to the source, he let off his resources in the water. Climate's climax, where the climate is at high degrees. He starts to breathe deep in the darkest seas. And the planets, the laying the clays that form land and expand, using the same clays to born man. In his own image, our origin begins in the east. Culture rise to free with the powers of peace. Dealing equality, nature's policy is to be gone. Build and destroy positively, born life like a law. And each one was given everlasting perfection. If each one keep living in the same direction, and life was life, and love was love. We went according by the laws of the worlds above. It showed us physically we can reach infinity, but mentally, through the century, we lost our identity. Life started ending, we got trife and started sinning. Lost touch with the beginning, now cipher stopped spinning. And what was once easy became confused and hard, which brings us back to the mystic question, who is God? 66 trillion years since his face was shown. When the seventh angel appears, the mystery will be known. Check Revelations and Genesis, say Luke and John. It even tells us we are gods in the Holy Quran. Wisdom, strength, and beauty, one of the meanings of God. G-O-D, you and me, go more R's to bar. Knowledge, wisdom, understanding, sun, moon, and star. Man, woman, and child, and so is the law. If you can, see if you can solve the mystery. The answer revolves around your history. So carefully, I drop this degree, scientifically and realistically. If you can, see if you can solve the mystery. So revolves around your history. So carefully, I drop this degree, scientifically and realistically.
Bear
witness to the law, gave birth to all. For law was all, and therefore life itself. And the universe gave birth to man. The universe was man, and man was a universe. And the universe was always existing. And existence was life, and life was a law. And the law had no beginning, because he is what always was. Rock him a law. Peace. Now, who is God?
Who was God? Asks Raheem. All right. Anything to say about that cut, Michael Muhammad Knight?
I think that should be studied, like, on a level of, like, classical Persian Sufi poetry, you know, in terms of, like, the imagery that he's using, the references, the esotericism of it. Like, there should be, like, you know, dissertations written about that.
Well, you're the one who's going up to Harvard, so there you go.
I guess so.
All right. We might consider taking some listener phone calls after I get through my rants. The number is 212-209-2900. Brief announcement. Just remember, there's going to be punk rock in Tompkins Square this coming Saturday, July 11th, with Scum City, Trauma Team 666, World War IV. I got to talk to those guys and see if they got their name from my website, because I didn't get the name from the band. So maybe they got the name from the website, or maybe great minds think alike. And the Blackout Shoppers, ha ha ha, Iconicide, and another band whose name I can't say on the air. So, once again, that's going to be this Saturday, July 11th, in Tompkins Square Park. That's it for announcements. Real briefly on the global politics tip, solidarity with Honduras and solidarity with East Turkestan should be obvious to people who, well, should be obvious to everybody why we're saying solidarity with Honduras. Should be obvious to anyone who listens to this radio show and follows the news why we're saying solidarity with East Turkestan. Michael, why are we saying solidarity with East Turkestan today?
I don't know, man. Why are we saying solidarity?
Because the Uyghurs have been having an uprising in Xinjiang, or East Turkestan, as they call it. 150 were killed over the weekend.
I didn't know that. Michael Jackson died.
Yeah.
Did you hear about that?
I didn't miss it. But is he? Well, he was a convert to to Sunni Islam or to NOI Islam, or
that's what they say. He had a relationship to the nation at one point. Louis Farrakhan actually, during the Million Man March planning, Michael said, "How can I help?" And Louis Farrakhan said, "Come to D.C. and perform Man in the Mirror."
Hmm.
And he was about to do it, and at the very last second, he backed out.
Oh, really?
So I don't know. I don't know where he's stood.
But Jermaine apparently
Definitely.
Yeah. Do you know if he's NOI or Sunni?
I believe he's Sunni, but I don't know.
Hmm. Anyway, solidarity with Peru. There was just a general strike brought Lima to a halt in protest of the transit fare hike, which was just instated there. How do you like that? And here in New York City, we also just had a transit fare hike instated without a peep of protest from anybody, hardly. So did you ever ask yourself, why is that? And finally, we say once again, solidarity with Iran, despite the fact that the protest movement seems to have been crushed for the moment. We are sure that it will reemerge in some capacity in the near future. So solidarity with Iran once again. And special message to Hugo Chavez, if you're listening tonight, which I'm sure he must be. Let me get this straight. We're supposed to be supporting the protesters in Honduras, but not supporting the ones in Iran? How does that work again? Maybe you can call in and explain it to us if you're listening out there, Hugo. 212-209-2900. Although, actually, I prevail upon the listeners to stay on topic and take advantage of the fact that we have Michael Muhammad Knight in the studio, author, once again, of The Five Percenters, Islam, Hip Hop, and the Gods of New York. Before we get to that, though, one thing I would like to talk about very, very briefly, which I really don't want to take phone calls on tonight. We'll do that some other night. But I want to put this out over the airwaves of a couple of things about BAI, to put out over the airwaves of BAI, just to keep our eye on the ball as events continue to develop here at the station. Michael, do you ever listen to WBAI?
I'm actually not in the city, so I don't get a chance to.
Really. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I'm in the wilderness of upstate.
Are you aware of the political mishigas here?
No, I can't say that I am.
Well, good for you. You're probably very happy in your ignorance compared to those of us who have been mired in it for all too long. All right. I once again, as I have several times before, I appeal to management to come clear as to, to make a clear statement as to whether, in fact, Bernard White and Io Harrington have been barred from the airwaves, and if so, why? Or if you feel that you are legally constrained from saying why, to at least make a clear statement to that effect. Because if there's going to be any kind of, a lot of people don't want to see healing, okay? A lot of people don't want to see resolving the debilitating factional divide here, but I do. And if that's going to happen, there is going to have to be, clarity on both sides and honesty in order for there to be any hope of reconciliation at all. So I appeal to management to make clear what the position is. And if, in fact, Io and Bernard, if their voices are banned from the airwaves, I protest that. So I would hope that the people in the Take Back WBAI camp are heartened that somebody is protesting the silencing of their partisans over the air. But I also have something to say to you, which is that for several weeks running now, I have been protesting the silencing of Bernard and Io, and I have suffered no repercussions, nor have I received a memo to the effect that there is a gag rule in effect. So why do you keep saying that there's a gag rule? Okay, I'm clearly, if there's a gag rule, I'm clearly violating it, and yet I have not been censured. I have not suffered any repercussions. So now you could argue that it's a repressive tolerance strategy, and that nobody cares what Bill Weinberg says at a quarter after one on a Tuesday night. Okay, that's a valid argument maybe, but it's still not exactly the same thing as a gag rule, right? So I'll believe that there's a gag rule when, in fact, I am gagged. So once again, I am calling on both sides to engage in a little bit of clarity and honesty. And in the interest of that, I would also, I'm not sure if I mentioned this before, but I would like to mention it now if I haven't mentioned it before. I would like to organize a debate over, I think I did mention this last week, didn't I? I would like to organize a debate between the two camps over these airwaves, with me mediating, and without, you know, it being in a actual public forum where, you know, the room is going to be stacked with hecklers who are going to try to shout down whoever's talking, but doing it over the airwaves. So it'll still be public and the whole universe can listen, but nobody can shout down whoever has the floor. I think that this would serve the purposes of at least of clarity and honesty, if not about actually building unity. So, and I would like to invite on representatives from either side who are on the board, but are not up for re-election. So there won't be any potential conflicts in terms of, you know, equal time for people who are out there electioneering for their positions on the local station board. So the names which I propose, just putting it out there, anybody who knows how to reach these people or, you know, those people themselves are listening tonight, get in touch with me here at the station. The names which I am proposing, I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe that none of these people are up for re-election. In one corner, Vajra Kilgour and Ray LaForest. In the other corner, Kathy Davis and Alex Steinberg. Those are the names which I am throwing out there. I would love to get the four of you in the studio, in front of the microphones, and let's have the issues out with me mediating. This is a very, very serious proposal which I am putting forth. So Vajra, Ray, Kathy, Alex, if you're listening tonight, you're invited to come on to the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade. We can't do it next week because I've got something else lined up for next week, but we can do it the week after. So we've got 2 weeks to get it together. Can we make that happen, folks? If anybody has any feedback, they can contact me here at the station, or they can call my voicemail at 212-631-1115. Please don't leave any hate messages. That will not endear me to your position if you leave hate messages. Just logistical stuff, please. Logistical stuff about how to make this on-air debate happen. 212-631-1115. With that, we've got just a few minutes left. Why don't people are trying to call in? So let's take some listener phone calls. We're not taking calls about BAI tonight. We'll have the opportunity to do that on another time, but not tonight. Tonight, we are just talking about The Five Percenters, Islam, Hip Hop, and the Gods of New York, the new book from Michael Muhammad Knight. So if you have any questions for Michael Muhammad Knight, this is your big opportunity. WBAI, you're on the air. No. WBAI, you're on the air.
Hello. Hi. Just one clarifying thing. The 5% has actually emerged. Hello?
You're there?
Yes. The 5% has emerged from the Nation of Islam. Is that correct?
Yes.
And there, what set them apart was the notion of essentially a kind of agnostic or atheistic thing where there isn't a divine God, but in fact God exists in each person.
Yeah, it's basically the idea that this abstract unseen God is an agent of oppression used by the ruling class. So you know,
it's almost a superposition of the ruling class, you might say.
I'm sorry?
You could say that in a way that divine God is almost a superposition of the ruling class.
Okay.
I mean, just as a thought.
Yeah, so you know, the way the lessons say it is like, you know, they decided to not waste time searching for that which does not exist. So by saying that they're gods, it's strictly, you know, it's a political commentary.
That's interesting because that's a very empowering thing to say.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, to me, like, you know, I'm a Muslim. You know, I believe in that unseen God. But what I got out of the 5% was just a statement on religious authority. So maybe I'm not saying I'm God, but I'm taking God in my hands and I'm owning him in a way.
Right, right. And taking responsibility, of course, for your behavior and your life.
Absolutely.
And what year did that actually begin?
64.
Yep. That's really you're great. It was a really interesting show. Now, may I ask the host one question?
Yes.
What was the name of the CD you played by the Wu-Tang Clan in the beginning of the show?
So you should ask Mike that.
That was a solo track by the RZA from the Wu-Tang.
I'm sorry? It was a solo track?
From the RZA, who's kind of like the head of the Wu-Tang Clan.
RZA.
And the CD was The Birth of a Prince.
The Birth of a Prince.
Yeah, the song was called The Birth.
Great song. And also, what did you play by Rakim?
That was The Mystery from the CD, The 18th Letter.
The 18th Letter. Hey, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you.
Thank
Bye-bye.
You. WBAI, you're on the air. WBAI, you're on the air. Every line? WBAI, you're on the air. Turn down your radio, please. Turn down your radio. Turn down your radio.
Hello?
Turn down your radio.
It's down. Hello?
Okay, speak up then.
Hi, I just had a quick question. Is there a connection between W.E.B. Du Bois's Talented Tenth and the 5% doctrine as it emerged?
I don't know of a direct connection, no.
Okay. Also, with all due respect, I have to say that the mystery, certainly Rakim being one of the top MCs of all time, but the beat is a little bit whack, I got to say. So I do respect what you're saying.
That's peace.
Thank you very much. Have
peace.
A good night. Bye.
WBAI, you're on the air. WBAI, you're on the air. He is on every line.
While weighing on the phone, I took a huge crap.
He is on every line. WBAI, you're on the air.
Hi there.
Hi.
I know that one of the major debates in the Muslim community now is actually what makes up indigenous Islam. And in America, so I was actually just wondering what Mike's thoughts were on that, given his search. And
Well, he's only written 6 books about the question.
Right. But I mean, it seemed to be something quite contended in the Muslim community as to what actually makes up, is actually indigenous, if it's something that boils almost solely out of the African-American experience, or if it's a bit more of a soup.
Well, there's all kinds of things. I mean, one, you have the intermingling of all these different immigrant cultures. You have the indigenous African-American movements, which have been called heretical and even non-Muslim by Sunnis. And then you just have, you know, people who, whether they're the children of immigrants or they're converts, are integrating Western culture into their Islam, whether that's feminism or, you know, particular lifestyle or whatever. So to me, like, you know, the indigenous Islam is the community and the traditions that we're developing as American Muslims. And I'm very inclusive when it comes to, you know, I'm not making a statement about what's authentic, you know, what's authentic Islam. You know, I'm not in the clouds. I can't say that. So if someone uses Islam, they're Muslim to me.
Okay, let's see if we can take another call. WBAI, you're on the air. You're on the air. Hello.
Hi.
Hi. You're on the air.
How you doing?
Speak up.
I remember when Crown Heights, Brooklyn, was blockbusted and redlined in the 60s. And all the people came in from Brownsville, Brooklyn. And I just, you know, I'd always wondered how these kids became 5%ers, because they eventually became a gang, the Jolly Stompers. Okay. And so I found myself being called white, blonde-haired, blue-eyed devil, that white people were invented
by an evil scientist in Africa.
It wasn't Africa, but...
To, okay. For 4,000 years ago, named Yakub.
6,000 years ago. Yeah.
6,000 years ago? Okay. All right. You know, somebody got to these kids, you know, they, you know, ended up on drugs, they ended up in gangs, they had a choice of going to prison, being killed, going into the military, you know, that was it, you know, and so that was their plight. You know, they became a very violent gang. You know, many of the, you know, people were involved. It was pretty horrible. I just recently found there was a guy named Clarence 13X.
Well, that was the Law of the Father. He founded the nation.
Yeah, we've been talking about this for the past hour and a half.
Right, well, I just tuned in.
Yeah.
Okay, so, you know, but, I mean, well, you know, you're talking about something in theory or something that's out of a book, and then there was what had manifested on the ground.
Well, that it manifested in lots of different ways on the ground. I mean, I knew people who, you know, the 5% put them in college. I know people who, you know, the 5% inspired them to get a PhD. So, you know, if in one particular neighborhood they were a violent gang, then that's unfortunate. But, you know, it's a very, very diverse community.
Well, let me ask you a question. Do the 5%ers hold with the NOI doctrine that the white race was created by Yakub 6,000 years ago? And
They go by those texts, mm-hmm. Yeah. And you know, like any tradition, some people read it very literally, and some people read it as an allegory. Mm-hmm. You know, for me personally, I don't believe in Yakub as a physical history, but I get what it means.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's see if we can squeeze in another couple of calls in the 5 minutes remaining to us. WBAI, you're on the air. You're on the air.
You suck.
That's very intelligent contribution. Thank you.
Even
more intelligent. How does he do that? He must have two telephones right side by side. I don't understand why people are devoted to such esoteric indulgences. WBAI, you're on the air.
Yeah, about the 5% is, I remember most of the public culture was, remember Barry Farber used to talk, the public knowledge is they were a violent street gang. That is the public perception.
That was
5% of the people who knew, and what was the rest of it? 95%?
This is territory we've been over already tonight, but Michael, briefly?
85% of the people are misled by the 10% ruling class.
All right, let's see if we can squeeze in one more call. One more intelligent call? Turn down your radio, please.
Okay.
Turn down the radio.
Yeah, quick. I got it.
Okay.
Radio down.
Okay. Speak up.
Yeah, I wanted to know, some time ago there was some young fellas that were supposed to be incarcerated in Rikers Island, but they put them in the tombs. They were called 5%ers. I didn't know, 5%ers or 10%. I didn't know what it means. And they were there until the riot. Whatever happened to those young men? The district attorney did not want them to go on trial because he didn't want to let them out free. And I always wanted to know what happened to them.
I'm sorry, I don't know. When was this?
This was in the 70s, right before, maybe 69, 70s, around that area. They were in the tombs until that big riot took place.
Yeah, there have been prison riots in the 70s that involved 5%ers on some level, but this specific incident, I don't know what you're asking about.
Let's see if we can squeeze in one more call. WBAI, you're on the air. WBAI.
Yahoo!
WBAI. Hello?
Hello. Yes, good morning.
Good morning.
Yes, how are you today?
Okay.
Yeah, assalamu alaikum, brother.
Alaikum salam.
All right, thank you for taking the call. One, I like to say, in terms of the books you've written.
Yes.
Right, in your travels, is it now an issue of just self-discovery and enlightenment, or is it just enlightenment, and now you kind of wanted to go through self-discovery and write these books? I know you come across a lot of different things in your travels and in your history of trying to find out your own end quest to Islam, and is it connected to a larger Dawah objective? Tell me.
In terms of a Dawah objective, you know, the best I can do for Islam is to show its diversity. Because everybody, you know, inside and outside of the community wants to paint a very narrow picture of Islam. And I think that that is negative, not only for non-Muslims, but also for Muslims, you know, who just don't know all the tools that exist within their tradition. So I try to show how diverse the tradition is. For me personally, you know, sometimes, you know, like in the case of the 5%, it was purely an academic research project, but it had a lot of personal meaning for me also, and it impacted me personally in the years since completing that research. So it all intertwines for me, the personal and the creative.
Well, I wish we had time to keep going with phone calls because the board is lit up and presumably only maybe 50% of them are complete wing nuts. We're wasting our time. So I would love to hear what the rest of you have to say, but unfortunately we have fallen under the tyranny of the clock, so to speak, and we have to be out of here to make way for Weaponry with Tom Whisker coming up next. So we'll take phone calls. The next time we are joined by Michael Muhammad Knight, author of The 5%ers, Islam, Hip Hop, and the Gods of New York, available from One World Press. Thanks so much for joining
us, Mike.
Thanks
for having me.
Okay.
Peace.
And should we go out with
Erykah Badu?
Please remember that this program is supported by the listener members of WBAI New York. If you like what you hear, please consider becoming a member of WBAI or renewing if you've already joined. Basic membership is $25, but we accept any amount. Help us keep free speech alive.